This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. After this month's shooting at Santa Fe High School in Texas, like the shooting before that and the one before that, tragedy after tragedy, we're left yet again to continue a conversation about our society and our culture and what it is that causes this epidemic of violence. Regardless of your views about the Second Amendment, how does a teenager, a kid, show up at a school determined to kill as many of his own classmates and teachers as he can? One answer to that question, by no means definitive, comes to us from staff writer Malcolm Gladwell, who looked for insights in the literature of sociology. In 2015, we published his article called Thresholds of Violence, and he spoke about what he'd learned with The New Yorker's executive editor, Dorothy Wickenden. Malcolm started off by talking about a shooting that didn't happen, a potential tragedy that was caught just in time.
There was this case of a kid named John Ledoux in a little town about an hour south of Minneapolis who is caught by police by surest chance. The police happen upon him in a rented storage locker where they find all of the ingredients for explosives. And they take him in to the police station, and he confesses that he was planning to essentially blow up his high school, to create the biggest school massacre ever. And he's not mentally ill. He's not wasn't abused or traumatized or bullied. He is an honor roll student. He's on the spectrum. He's a kid with what we used to call Asperger's. But he's in no way, I think this sort of speaks volumes. His parents are incredibly alarmed because he's in police custody and they don't realize that, and the cops haven't called them. And the reason they're alarmed is it's past 9 o'clock and he's never out past 9 o'clock. You know, he's that kind of dutiful a child.
And they had no idea he was compiling weapons and bomb-making materials?
They knew that he made bombs, but then—
And that didn't cause alarms?
But wait a minute.
That's not normal behavior?
It's totally normal behavior.
Normal behavior.
Kids had been making little bombs. He made little bombs, not big bombs. Kids have been playing with chemistry sets and making bombs for as long as there have been chemistry sets. I can name to you editors of The New Yorker, and you can probably guess who made bombs as kids. This is a normal thing for adolescents to experiment with explosives. You know, especially adolescent boys.
So his parents really thought he was completely normal.
He was a science geek, which is what he is. He was, in fact, in what comes clear in his confession, is that his interest in killing other people is minimal. He has barely even thought about that.
So what motivates him? And he also, by the way, did differentiate himself very clearly from Adam Lanza.
He doesn't
like
this.
He said, I am not Adam Lanza.
Yeah, no. He had no—well, he wasn't—to my mind, it's unclear whether he even would have gone through with it had he not been caught. He got obsessed with the technical question of what it would take to blow up a school successfully. And he was particularly obsessed with Columbine. And as he points out, Columbine is a failure. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold intended to blow up their school in Littleton, Colorado, in Columbine High School, and failed. And that's why they started shooting everyone, right? So in his purely kind of narrow, obsessive way, he's just trying to solve the technical problem that has bedeviled his predecessors.
Could you talk a little bit about the sociologist you wrote about who studied riot behavior as a form of social contagion? And you apply his theories to the evolution of school shootings. What do they have in common? You know, a riot builds among a number of people in one time and place. These are the acts almost always of solitary geeks, as you say, who are working through their own obsessions. How do you compare those two phenomena?
Yeah. Mark Granovetter is the name of this, one of the great, if not the greatest American sociologists of the last 50 years. And he had a theory about riots, which is the mistake when you look at a riot is to assume that every rioter has the same set of motivations and that every rioter is identical. Imagine we've got one person who's a bit of a radical and he's really upset about something and he throws a rock through a window. He doesn't need anyone else around to do that first. He's willing to act on his own as the first guy. He has what Granovetter would say, a threshold of zero. He requires no other person to go before him to do a radical act. Someone else might watch this and say, oh, I'm going to join in. That person would never have acted if they were the first, but they'll act if someone else goes first. They have a threshold of one. Then there's someone else who's a little more conservative. They would never be the first in. They would never even be the second in. But they would be the third in, threshold of three. And he goes all the way up. If you have a riot of 100 people, you could hypothetically have a group of 100 people, each of whom had a different threshold ranging from 0 to 99. The 99th person in is my mother, right? She's the person. My mother would not be the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. But if absolutely every one of her cronies from church were rioting, she might riot.
Have you told her that? I don't think she'd be happy to hear that at all.
But no. Well, my mother would probably say she was in the 70s. But but that's a really very different way of understanding a riot. So when I read that, I thought, oh, this is really interesting because we see the same thing with school shootings.
How so? That's what I wanted to pin you down on. Like, take one of these school shooters. Where do they fit in this paradigm?
So John Ledoux, when we compare John Ledoux, the kid I was writing about last year, to the kids who were doing school shootings in the early 90s, it's night and day. If you take a look at the list of the first six major school shootings in this country— or the ones leading up to Columbine, what you see are kids with profound psychosis, kids who had the most brutal childhoods imaginable. I mean, you just cannot imagine, you know, how bad they're... Or kids who fit the clinical definition of psychopathology, psychopaths. Eric Harris is a textbook psychopath. I mean, there's nothing normal about that kid. So in the beginning, you see these kind of florid indices of pathology. But by the time we get to John Ledoux, as we get—
So he's like number three who would be joining the riot?
It's not a perfect, you know, you can't do the perfect sequence like Granovetter has. But I think you can observe in a very general way over time the fact that the longer this phenomenon persists— the more likely it is for someone who is relatively normal to participate.
How big a problem is the availability of guns?
Oh.
This is such a huge part of our political debate.
Well, those who say that you can solve this problem with gun control are engaging in a fantasy. Can you prevent some cases of this by locking up all the guns? Sure. Is that politically possible in the near term in the United States? No. My problem with the gun control argument is that it so grossly simplifies what's going on here. That this is, you know, we had tons and tons of guns in this country and no school shootings for a long time. So school shootings are not a necessary or inevitable consequence of having lots of guns. What we're looking at here is a powerful, contagious, adolescent cultural pathology that has used the availability of guns to extend its reach. Now, let me say one crucial thing here. This should in no way undermine the importance of gun control.
That's what I was waiting for you
this
to say.
Gun control can solve the much bigger problem of the kind of unpremeditated shootings done in the heat of passion or drunkenness or drug use that claim the lives of tens of thousands of Americans every year. That's the reason to ban guns. School shootings are a wholly separate and more complex phenomenon. Let's not muddy the waters by trying to extend an incredibly powerful and important social initiative to this specific difficult issue of school shootings.
So what do you say then to mothers and fathers of teenage boys who might be interested in building little bombs or who have an obsession with guns? That, too, is a very common phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Is there nothing to do to alleviate the contagion, to bring it down, bring it back?
Well, I do think that we should explore ways of making experimentation with bombs and guns socially safe. So instead of stopping it, you should do the opposite. In other words, you reacted with alarm when I talked about how adolescent boys like to make bombs.
I have two girls. That's
why. Yes, that's right. But our response should be the opposite. It should be like, this is a phase that many adolescent boys go through. They're genuinely and legitimately fascinated with these. And by the way, the people who played with their chemistry sets and blew things up as children, many of them went on to be
great chemists.
Great chemists. They, you know, they contributed to some of the greatest scientific successes of the 20th century. So, you know, this impulse can be channeled in very positive directions. Let's do that, as opposed to so denying that it exists. I will also say that, you know, if you were a 17-year-old in the United States, anywhere from, you know, the First World War through to the end of the draft in the early 70s, your desire to play with guns as an adolescent was satisfied when you got drafted. And that ended. And I wonder whether that this isn't a kind of unintended consequence of the end of compulsory military service.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Malcolm.
Thank you.
That was staff writer Malcolm Gladwell. You can find his article Thresholds of Violence at NewYorker.com, and his most recent book is David and Goliath. He spoke with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Our political columnist Susan Glasser writes from Washington every week, and next week she'll talk with Senator Marco Rubio about how to lead as a Republican in the age of Donald Trump. As we head into the primary season, the Democratic Party is expressing a lot of optimism. But to be sure, There are many unresolved issues in play having to do with impeachment, the election of 2016, and much, much more. As Mark Lilla sees it, the Democrats' troubles predate the 2016 election. In fact, they go back decades. Lilla is a self-described liberal and a Columbia professor of the humanities. In his book, The Once and Future Liberal, he argues that identity politics on the left have been responsible for sidelining the Democratic Party in elections. Now, this is an argument that infuriates a lot of liberals, which I think was deliberate on his part, because the Once and Future Liberal aims to change how Democrats think. I talked with Mark Lilla after the book came out in August of 2017.
There is a quote recently that Steve Bannon, of all people, delivered. The Democrats, the longer they talk about identity politics, I've got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity, and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats. And you have said it works for them, it being identity politics. It doesn't work for us. And there seems to be some link, not that I'm saying your politics by any chance are the same as Steve Bannon's, but you're saying a similar thing, aren't you?
I just think it's an objective fact. He has no reason to lie about this. And the past two generations of our politics, I think, demonstrates exactly that works for their side and it doesn't work for our side for all kinds of reasons. Now, that is not to say that we don't talk about identity. To understand any social problem in this country, you have to understand identity, and we're more aware of that than ever, and that's been a very good thing. But to address those problems with politics, we have to abandon the rhetoric of difference in order to appeal to what we share so that people who don't share this identity somehow can have a stake and feel something that other people are experiencing. To give you an example, I'm not a black motorist. I will never be a black motorist. I don't know what it's like to look in the rearview mirror of a car and see the lights flashing and feel my stomach churn, right? But I am a citizen, and that person is a fellow citizen. And if we can make the case that there are citizens in this country who can't just go for a drive without being worried about this, and they won't be equally protected by the law, I think I can make the case to people who aren't black that that's a terrible thing, right? And so I want to frame the issue in terms of basic values and principles that we share in order to establish sympathy and empathy and identification with someone else.
But Mark, what are you asking African-Americans to do? Be a little less specific, a little more polite somehow? You're asking them to be less aggressive in their demand for justice, whether it's on the road or on the street? I'm not quite – this is where I understand the overall yearning for a more generalized rhetoric of us, of liberal values, of civil rights. I'm not sure why you have the disdain you do, the suspicion that you do for a group like Black Lives Matter, that you're saying that they are going about it in all the wrong way, or unless I'm misunderstanding.
Well, I mean, to read the full passage of what I said about Black Lives Matter, I said, Black Lives Matter is a textbook example of how not to build solidarity. There's no denying that by publicizing and protesting police mistreatment of African Americans, the movement mobilized supporters and delivered a wake-up call to every American with a conscience. I'm totally on board with that, right?
So what did Black Lives Matter do that you're at best ambivalent about and very critical, really?
Right, and then I say, but there's no denying that the movement's decision to use this treatment to build a general indictment of American society and its law enforcement institutions and to use Mau Mau tactics to put down dissent and demand a confession of sins and public penitence played into the hands of the Republican
right. Mark, Mau Mau tactics. Are you familiar?
Of course I remember. What was that confrontation they had with Hillary Clinton, if not that, right? They were shouting down people at various venues. No, those are Mau Mau tactics, sure.
You're comfortable with that phrase?
Sure. I mean, you know, Mau Mau tactics, I'm also thinking of—
No, I remember the opening of the Tom Wolfe piece.
Tom Wolfe, right?
Some of the criticism that's aimed at your book has less to do with the generalized demand for a more common politics and a desire to win than it is for a certain tonal thing. There's a tone to the book that you have been offended by politics on campus in a way that seems outsized. Can you address that? What's been your experience on campus of identity politics that offends you?
Well, to begin with, what leads to my frustration and my tone is that I'm sick of noble defeats. I'm tired of losing. I'm sickened by the fact that Donald Trump is in power right now. And not just that, but that Republicans control two-thirds of our state legislatures, two-thirds of our governorships, 24 states outright. They win two more. They can call a constitutional convention. Mm-hmm. To my mind, that is the biggest threat to every group that Democrats care about. That's the most important threat.
And it's impossible to have both at once. You can't have a winning strategy without maintaining some semblance of a concentration on identity.
Well, when it comes to the distinction I'm trying to make between analyzing a social problem and developing a political program in order to win power, you know, people who are in movement politics fail to see the distinction, I think, because identity politics is maximalizing. That's how you succeed. You see this as the only issue, right? There's a difference between speaking truth to power and seizing power to defend the truth. And those require very different things, right?
Unless I misread your book, you seem to say that in the interest of winning, and politics is about power ultimately, that the Democratic side ought to think about abandoning certain issues, certain kinds of rhetoric in order to win. But abandoning certain things like full-throated opposition to bathroom bills will mean that certain people, transgender people, some of the most vulnerable people in our society, will get hurt. How does a party go about sacrificing people on the altar of the general good?
Well, my main point is this, and I want to get this across. We cannot do anything for these groups we care about if we do not hold power. It is just talk. Therefore, our rhetoric in campaigning must be focused on winning so then we can help these people. An election is not about self-expression. It's not a time to display everything we believe about everything. It's a contest. And once you hold power, then you can do the things you want to do. So your rhetoric has to be mobilizing, and it's got to mobilize.
But you can imagine how outraged a transgender person would feel about such a tactic.
Of course, of course. And the situation of transgender people is you know, can be very, very difficult, especially young people who feel trapped in a body, and suicide rates are terrible and homeless rates are terrible. But let's be concrete about this. Transgender people make up less than one half of 1% of the country. There is no electoral group that we're trying to mobilize. That's not to say that we don't want to help them and focus on that when we analyze our problems and when we get into power. But that is not how you seize power in this country, especially in the states we need to win. Look, we have the two coasts. We need to go to the middle of the country. It's a question of vision. And you know, what was extraordinary about Reagan is that up until 1980, the Republican Party had all these warring factions and they didn't have one message. And once Reagan offered this vision of very simple vision of the country, all of those groups, the differences between those groups became much less important because they all saw themselves in this vision. And that's what has to happen to us. That we need to be able to put forward a vision so that African Americans look at it and say, those are the principles I stand for. And white working class people look at it too, and they aren't thinking so much about their differences.
Mark, you mentioned Joe Biden as somebody who gets it. Joe Biden was probably the clearest and foremost voice for gay marriage in the Obama administration.
Oh, of course, yeah. But how do we get gay marriage? It was not just that there was a fiat from above. On the contrary, is that this change happened socially. It happened in families. It happened at dinner tables when children came out to their parents. Sometimes parents came out to their kids, right? So,
but it also happened because you had people in the streets shouting, we're here, we're queer, which is a which is something that in the book that you say will only get you a pat on the head. Didn't that help get power too? Didn't Stonewall help get power? Civil rights movement helped get power?
That's, again, just to focus on one particular issue and one particular group. And if each group is just thinking about itself, it's not thinking like a party. Party politics right now has to come first, because we cannot help any of these people if we don't get elected. And as long as we think of ourselves as groups and think now, as the Democratic Party is, which has me worried, that now they have to just add another group or shift to another group, which is the white working class, we're not going to get anywhere.
Mark, you've described a kind of scheme in our recent politics of two, you call them dispensations, the Roosevelt dispensation and the Reagan dispensation. Is it your hope somehow to return to the Roosevelt dispensation, the idea that government exists to solve problems?
No, that can't be done, because our situation is very different. To begin with, we've learned that the government can only do so much and that certain programs don't work, and we understand that better. The economic situation is completely different. We have a globalized economy. It's no longer possible to organize labor in the way we used to. Women are part of the workforce. All kinds of things have changed, but our basic principles, I think, haven't changed, and that is that we stick together. Citizens are not roadkill. We take care of each other. And secondly, that we stand for the equal protection under the law. And if we can only articulate what those two principles might mean in the present, I think we would be able to move on from our obsession with or our self-limitation to identity in order to reach out to people we haven't been able to reach out to.
Mark Lilla, thank you very much.
Okay, that was fun. Thanks.
Mark Lilla is the author of The Once and Future Liberal and a professor of humanities at Columbia University. I spoke with him in August 2017. If you're any kind of film buff, you know the name Paul Schrader. He's one of the great screenwriters of our time, the collaborator with Martin Scorsese on Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. As a director, though, Schrader has struggled to get his own films made. So alongside acclaimed titles like American Gigolo and Mishima, there are movies like an Exorcist prequel that are probably best forgotten. Schrader's new film, First Reformed, has just come out, starring Ethan Hawke. And in the view of Richard Brody, who writes about film for The New Yorker, First Reformed is one of the best movies by one of our great filmmakers. Paul Schrader is one of Richard's heroes, an auteur in the true sense, a writer and a director with a distinctive style informed by his predecessors, but with a set of concerns that are all his own.
And that's exactly what the company wants. To keep you on the line. They'll do anything to keep you on their line. They pit the lifers against the new boys, the old against the young, the black against the white, everybody to keep us in our place. I mean, can't you understand that?
A lot of people, when they hear the name Paul Schrader, they think of Taxi Driver. I first knew of his work from Blue Collar, which was, I thought, a fierce and passionate movie.
You're trying to hurt somebody instead of helping yourself. That's your problem.
I got a problem now.
There's a kind of shattering, awe-inspiring intensity to the best of Schrader's films that no other living filmmaker can match.
All right, so how do we help ourselves?
Blackmail.
I
think the reason why Schrader is not thought of in the same way as certainly Spielberg or Coppola or Scorsese is that precisely because of the nature of his upbringing, his films don't have the same pop culture hooks as theirs do. Schrader grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in a strict Dutch Calvinist community. And he depicts that way of life in his 1979 film, Hardcore.
Well, T stands for total depravity. All men, through original sin, are totally evil and incapable of good. All my works are as filthy rags in the sight of the Lord.
Paul Schrader, you were brought up in a very stern religious environment.
Well, yeah, in retrospect, you know, I mean, you're not quite aware how you're different when you don't see anyone else who is different. And so if you go to church three times on Sunday with a Dutch service in the afternoon, and you go to a catechism twice a week, and then you have Bible classes every single day in school, and all your activities are church-sponsored, You're just normal. You're not different. You're like everybody else. In truth, it was a very good upbringing. And Calvinism is a rather intellectual form of Protestantism. So they believed in education. Calvin believed you could actually think your way into heaven.
So there's no sense of extreme authority placed on you at home?
Well, yeah, I mean, there were certain things you did and did not do.
Well, you didn't see a movie until you were how old, 17?
Yeah, well, our denomination had a prescription against worldly amusements, of which movies were one. But because we didn't have TV and movies, there was a lot of storytelling. Sundays, go over to our grandmother's house after the service, and the uncles would sit around the table and tell what happened that week. And if you were a kid, you could sit in the room, you couldn't speak. And, you know, you tell me which is better, sitting in front of a TV, you know, hearing that manufactured plot line, or hearing your uncles tell about their day.
Two of Schrader's early influences were Bergman and Bresson. Both of them made films that dramatized varieties of spiritual torment.
I didn't think too much about movies until I got to college. And this was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And there was a softcore porn theater, Russ Meyer kind of place, that was running out of business. And the owner had this brilliant idea to have a three-week Ingmar Bergman Festival. And I guess he got a real bargain on them. And kids from the college started going over there. You know, and I went over there and I saw Through a Glass Darkly. And, you know, Bergman is talking about the very same things we're talking about in class and in church. And I realized that, you know, these two items are not incompatible, you know. We were just taught they were incompatible, but they're not. And because my first real love of the movies was the intellectual European cinema of the 60s, that has informed me. You know, you never forget your first love.
Right, exactly. But when you got to Hollywood, many of your colleagues of your generation had already a great orientation in the commercial cinema, whereas you were entering the realm of commercial cinema with an orientation in the severely intellectual movies.
Yeah, and, well, something happened in March of 1969. I went to a screening of Pickpocket at the Los Feliz.
You mean Robert Bresson's film, Pickpocket?
Je sais que d'habitude, ceux qui ont fait ces choses se taisent.
I said, wait a second. I said, I can make a film like that. He writes in his journal, and he goes out and commits some crimes, and he comes back and writes in his journal. Then he goes out and talks to the girl next door, and he writes in the journal some more. I said, I could make that film. And then 4 years later, I wrote Taxi Driver.
You wrote the film, but you didn't direct it.
No, I didn't even write. I wrote it purely as a self-therapy. I had hit a very, very rough period. I'd been living in my car. I got a pain in my stomach, went to the hospital. I had a bleeding ulcer. I'm 26. And I realized I hadn't been talking to people in weeks. There was something growing inside of me. I was becoming something. And if I didn't pull this thing out, it would become me. And the thing that I felt I was becoming was Travis Bickle.
I just want to go out and, you know, like really, really, really do something.
Taxi life, you mean?
Yeah, well, nah, it's, I don't know. I just want to go out. I really, you know, I really want to. I got some bad ideas in my head.
Schrader made one of the most auspicious debuts as a director of any filmmaker of his time. His first three films are all classics in their way: Blue Collar, Hardcore, and American Gigolo. Schrader himself has said that, you know, he really became a director with his third film, American Gigolo. And I think in part that's true. That's the film in which he most conspicuously crafts a style of his own.
Did you make the right decision to come here last night? Was it what you expected?
No. It was like really making love.
Throughout the 1990s, Schrader continued to make a series of films that were justifiably acclaimed, but that didn't quite establish him as a commercial filmmaker in Hollywood. Hollywood studio movies of that era were increasingly pop culture-oriented in a way that Schrader, because of his own background, isn't. Because of his worsening relations with the studios, he got to the point with The Canyons in 2012 where he had to put in some of his own funds and raise other funds with Kickstarter. Schrader's main theme is the sin of doing for money what should be done for love, and in The Canyons, he centers it on his own lifelong activity, namely filmmaking, filmmaking in Hollywood.
I was going to do a film with Bret Easton Ellis, but I said to Bret, the economy of the film business has changed so radically, I think we could just do one. You know, we'll put some money together, we'll raise some money over the internet, and we'll just make the film ourselves. And so we were able to cast people we couldn't cast otherwise, Lindsay Lohan, because she is not insurable. And then Bret was very keen on me hiring this porn star, James Dean. And so we pulled it off, we sold it, we made money, I would never do it again.
Yeah, from what I've read, the process was fairly stressful, making of that film.
Well, it always is stressful for one reason or another. And this reason had a lot to do with Lindsay and her problem behavior. You know, really frustrating circumstances where you say to someone, you explain, if you do these things, it's going to be great for you. You have 13 shooting days. If you can show up ready to work in good spirits for 13 days, you'll be back on the boards. She got it. She totally got it. She couldn't do it.
And it's really unfortunate because I thought that her performance in it, the performance you elicited from her, and it was really pretty wonderful.
You're not happy, Tara.
Who said anything about happy? He takes care of me, and he's in love with me. It's serious. Fuck it, Ryan. Who's happy? Who's really happy? Tell me.
Gina.
Oh, of course.
Gina is. Gina's happy.
Right, another reason why I couldn't stand being around her.
Are you washed?
Paul Schrader's new movie is called First Reformed.
My hands shake as I write these lines.
Are you washed in the blood?
First Reformed looks like a sort of religious drama. I don't take it as a religious drama. I take it as a work of political fury, where Taxi Driver was an eruption of rage at the duplicity, the corruption, the violence of the Vietnam War era. So First Reformed is a work of fury at the wanton violence of America's post-9/11 endless wars and the political and religious corruption that come along with it. In First Reformed, Ethan Hawke plays a minister in a small church in upstate New York who's in a state of spiritual, emotional, and physical torment. He counsels a parishioner who's an eco-terrorist, and he then makes that man's cause his own. What Ernst Toller, the protagonist of First Reformed, and Travis Bickle have in common is profound alienation and rage at the state of society. It's as if the violence of the outer world has seeped into his own bones and now is about to burst out.
This is a damaged man. He has a sickness that Kierkegaard called the sickness unto death, despair. So he makes a leap that maybe a more sanguine person wouldn't make. You know, there's a lot of blood in the DNA of Christianity. And when Christians start to go off the rail, this is the way they often go, which is they start confusing the sacrifice that Jesus made for them with the sacrifice they can make for themselves. The idea that my suffering will earn me glory.
Jesus doesn't want our suffering. He suffered for us. Mm-hmm. He wants our commitment and our obedience.
And what of his creation? The heavens declare the glory of God. God is present everywhere in every plant, every river, every tiny insect. The whole world is a manifestation of his holy presence. I think this is an issue where the church can lead, but they say nothing.
You were brought up in a religious household, and you've just made a movie about a minister. Do you mind if I ask you, what is your particular relationship to faith now?
I've gone through phases in my life. When I had children, I became Episcopalian because I was raised with all the rules and none of the ritual. And Episcopalians is all the ritual and none of the rules. So that seemed like a good idea. But now recently I've switched the last couple of years Presbyterian. What kind of believer am I? I don't know. I mean, Camus said that I don't believe, I choose to believe. You know, I mean, there is something about setting some time aside on Sunday morning to organize your week. You know, people don't walk out of church because they're bored. They go to church to be bored and to have that quasi-meditative hour and a half. And so I still welcome that.
In effect, the slow cinema of the spiritual life.
Yes. And yeah, and that's one of the attractions of actual cinema, too, is that you, just like you make a commitment to drive over to church, you make a commitment to drive over to the cinema.
And do you have a sense that the faith in cinema, so to speak, is decreasing because it's being consumed at home more casually?
You know, when people take movies seriously, it's very easy to make serious movies. When I was coming up in the 60s and 70s, people actually took movies seriously. They wanted to know. They looked for answers. What about this women's movement, this gay movement, this drug movement? You know, give us some movies that sort of explain that. And, of course, we gave them movies that explained it, and it was a wonderful period. Now people aren't asking that question anymore. They're not saying, you know, explain Donald Trump in a movie because we've got, well, because he is a movie, I guess. I mean, because there's no real center to the culture, and it hurts us. But, you know, that is a much bigger thing than movies.
Writer and director Paul Schrader talking with The New Yorker's Richard Brody. Schrader's new film, First Reformed, is in theaters now. I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. And in a minute, we'll look back at summer jobs, good, bad, and awful, mostly awful. That's ahead.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the magazine, we've often asked writers to tell us about their most memorable experiences and jobs. You know the kind I mean. Not the jobs that you put on your resume on the gliding career path to success, but the ones that you're still telling stories about 10, 20, or 50 years later. We're going to share three of those stories with you today. First off, Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl and many other books.
My parents were a very budget-minded couple, so I did not have a lot of extra spending money, so a job was always in the picture. And I went through a whole series of jobs in my high school years. I first tried being a shop girl, which was absolutely completely pathetic because I was pathologically shy. So I never really talked to people. I would kind of hover near them, which everyone loves to have when they're trying on clothes and feeling vulnerable as some idiot nearby silently smiling and shrugging their shoulders. So I got fired from that one. That's the only job I've ever been fired from for cause. And I, for years, would hire on at Honey Baked Ham, especially when they had their big holiday rushes. And so my job was basically a ham display girl. I was like the Vanna White of ham. So all these jobs, I feel like, kind of prepared me to take on the most perfectly 80s job ever, which was to sell frozen yogurt at a mall by my house. And it being the 80s, it was a very Fast Times at Ridgemont High kind of moment. It was very cool to be in the center of this mall. Frozen yogurt was blowing people's minds. They were like, it's frozen, but it's yogurt. And you can get it in a waffle cone or a cup of different sizes. They were going nuts. You know, are you telling me Reese's Pieces can be put on this? What? Months into it, I arrived at work one morning and my manager asked to see me in back. And this already felt very ominous. And when I went into this back room, I could see behind him in the dark some sort of giant white orb and then a pair of long, slender, wrinkled slacks. And my first thought was, my God, I think he's killed someone. Am I going to be an accessory to murder? I'm going to have to, like, this is such a bummer. I did not sign up for this. But it turned out it was actually much worse than that. It was an actual yogurt costume he had bought at some sort of flea market. It was clearly used. And that he wanted me to put it on. He thought I would be perfect for this job because every girl at 16 dreams of wandering around a mall dressed as a formal dairy product. So on went the giant white orb, which made me incredibly top-heavy. And then I put on these strange crumpled black pants, which turned out to be a tuxedo. And I've always wondered, ever since that moment, why the tuxedo? Like, where did the yogurt think he was going? Was it prom? But he seemed too old for prom. It was like, well, maybe was it a wedding? Was he jilted at the altar and now he's doomed to wander the mall forever looking for his runaway bride and killing young girls on their way to get their ears pierced at Claire's Accessories? It's what he looked like because he had a very grim face. There was no smile. He already looked sort of haunting. And as I started wandering around the mall, I only made it more disturbing because, you know, again, I didn't want to talk or interact with anyone. So I just kind of floated in this top-heavy, directionless way, carrying a tray of yogurt samples, which no one dared come near me to get. Inside the giant yogurt head was a mini fan that I was very concerned about because it was whirling dangerously close to my beautiful, fantastic Sam spiral perm. So I did my loop around the mall, dumped all my samples into a nearby trash can, and went to report back to the yogurt store. And I was very close to safety. I was almost there when I kind of felt this tug. And this heard this grinding whir and the smell of Aussie hair spray combined with smoke. And I realized that the mini fan had gotten hold of some tendrils of my fantastic Sam's spiral perm and had caught it up in the motor. I couldn't get it off my head. And I kind of panicked and I had to decide, you know, perm or freedom. And I went for freedom and just yanked that thing off. Left some perm behind. But as I looked in the mirror, I realized that it was nothing, a ton of hair gel and a very carefully placed scrunchie. wouldn't fix. And luckily, I had a lot of both of those. But the moral of the story for me is, to this day, I am always kind to people dressed as food.
Gillian Flynn is the author of Grown Up, Gone Girl, and other books. In the last few years, Akhil Sharma has published quite a few short stories and essays in The New Yorker. His novels include Family Life and An Obedient Father, which won a Penn Hemingway Award. So we should all be thankful that his original plan didn't quite work out.
I am a deeply lazy man who is also incredibly greedy. I went to law school, and somebody told me that while lawyers make good money, investment bankers make even more money. And everybody was applying for these jobs because everybody had the same attitude. It was wretched in many ways. There were the very, very, very nice investment banks, the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanleys. And they would have their interviews in at the Charles Hotel, which was a fancy hotel in Cambridge. And then the less prosperous ones would have their events at the Sheraton Commander, which at least back then was sort of decrepit. And we would line up in the hallways of the Sheraton Commander, because those of us who were not especially good applied for everything, because why not? And so we would line up in the Sheraton Commander holding our little resumes, waiting to go in for interviews. And even among a group of people who were unqualified, I felt that I was especially unqualified. I knew nothing about math. I had no background which suggested finance. I wasn't even sure what exactly finance was, what exactly investment bankers did. And I would arrive in these interviews and they would ask me things like, what would you do in this situation or that situation? And the only phrase that I really knew was discount cash flow. So I would offer that up for everything. And at some point they said to me, okay, other than that, how else can you value a company? And then I just became quiet. You know, I knew right away that there was no reason to hire me. And so I thought the only way that they would hire me was if I could tell a convincing story. And so these guys looked at me. They saw that I was a brown guy, an Indian. And they were very open to the stories of me being an immigrant. And at some point, I decided to start lying. I began telling stories about working at a 7-Eleven, about working at gas stations. And then, because I was telling these stories, and these didn't seem pitiful enough, I also claimed that I worked at a 7-Eleven and a gas station at night. I was always something of a writer, and so I enjoyed making up these details. The kids who would come in Saturday night and begin stealing candy and comic books and bags of potato chips, or leaving in the morning when my shift was over and smelling like hot dogs. The alcoholics who would show up at 2 in the morning to buy beer, or the fat blonde prostitute who would come out and hang out at the gas station. They loved this stuff. They were great stories because they weren't true. Look, I grew up with nice middle-class parents in Edison, New Jersey. You know, I did not grow up in great deprivation. I was playing right along with their expectations, which frankly I did not mind, you know. Like, hey man, if you are willing to see me in this ridiculous way, then I'm happy to take advantage of that. And so they, you know, so I would keep moving on to do these interviews. And usually the people who have no patience for stories are the people who actually do the work. So the associates and the junior VPs, because they're the poor schnooks who are up there late at night, you know, making sure that everything in the Excel model is working. And almost always they were the guys who would ding me, who would say, look, come on, this guy knows nothing. He would be terrible. We can't have him around. What is he going to do? He's going to sit around and tell stories. And I finally did an interview with somebody, I think the junior VP I was supposed to interview with, was called into a meeting, and so he couldn't interview me. And I knew right then that I was going to get the job. And a couple of days later, I got a job offer, and I accepted on the spot. Because my thinking was these people could come to their senses. So I said, yes, I'll take it. And the guy seemed quite surprised because I wasn't trying to negotiate. I wasn't trying to, you know, I didn't even say, hey, I'd love to work for you. I just said, I'll take it. And then, of course, the next thing I asked was, when do I get my signing bonus?
Former investment banker and novelist, Akhil Sharma.
I remember later on when I was a banker, I was great with clients because it was the same thing. You know, the shtick I could handle, the actual work was a bit beyond me.
Sharma is a professor of creative writing at Rutgers University, and you can find everything he's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. I'm David Remnick, and you've been listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and we're going to close up now with just one more job story about the shortest job that Alison Bechdel ever had. Bechdel is a cartoonist, the author of Fun Home, and Are You My Mother? Here she is.
It was 1984. I was living in Brooklyn, and one lovely spring evening, my girlfriend and I went for a walk, and we were walking down one of those long downhill streets in Brooklyn, down from the park. And, you know, we were young lesbians in New York City in the early 80s, and we were dressed as such. We were, I'm sure, both wearing Levi's. My girlfriend probably had her denim jacket on. I had very short hair. She had short hair on top and long hair in the back, as people did in those days sometimes. And all of a sudden, this guy on one of the brownstone stoops called out to us. And he said, hey, you fellas want to make $5? So we walked over, and as soon as we got close, he could see that we were not two boys, as he had thought, but two adult women. But he was sort of taken aback, but he didn't flinch. He said, I need someone to carry this desk up to the third floor. And we were both pretty burly. I was in training for my black belt exam then, and my partner had just gotten back from Nicaragua, where she was helping the Sandinistas bring in the coffee harvest. So sure, we could carry this desk upstairs. So we picked it up, and there we went. As we were carrying this heavy desk up the stairs, I remember feeling this great sense of freedom, you know, that something about passing for boys made me feel like safe and powerful. You know, as a woman walking down the street, you're always kind of you're very vulnerable. So this was a cool sensation of having this kind of mobility in the world that was really thrilling. When I tell this story now, it makes me think of my mother. The kind of things that my girlfriend and I were doing, those were not things women in my mother's generation did. And my mother would always say to me, you know, when I was young, I had three options. I could be a teacher, I could be a nurse, or I could go downtown and work at the Sylvania factory. Those were the only options for women to work. So we carried it all the way up to the top floor of this brownstone, up three flights of stairs with this heavy desk as the guy sort of nervously trailed along behind us. And at the top, we set it down and he pulled out his wallet and gave us $5. And we walked downstairs, kind of rolling our eyes, very pleased with ourselves, and took the money and got ice cream cones with it.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Sharon Shetty, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.